We're in the second week of a three-week series that we're doing through the book of Psalms, which since there's 150 of them, it seems a little anemic to do 3 weeks on it, right? With all the stuff that we have at our disposal. But yet, that's where we are. And we're talking about the Psalms in as much as we're talking about developing a language of faith. How do we allow the Psalms to create the language and the patterns that help us to engage and interact with God, specifically in prayer, but recognizing that almost anything in our lives can become prayer? How do we respond to God? How do we create open dialogue and channels so that we might interact with Christ? See, the Psalms function both in the history of Israel and in the life of the church as an instruction book in life and language and in the way that we pray and praise. And that's an incredibly important thing because I believe, at least in my experience, to sing, to pray with any level of authenticity, to express oneself, as profoundly critical as that is, it's often hard for us. Why? Because to sing and to pray is to make ourselves vulnerable, to open ourselves up to things that sometimes we might not want to recognize in ourselves, let alone make available to somebody else. And so we're doing this thing in Psalms to become more conversant in the language and the patterns of prayer and praise and engagement with God. We've been talking about this trajectory using an Old Testament theologian's category for the Psalms of Psalms of orientation, Psalms of disorientation, and Psalms of reorientation, recognizing in the canon of the Psalms, there's three kind of categories of Psalms. Psalms about orientation. What does that mean? Well, in Psalms of orientation, when you read through them, like we talked about last week, all is as it should be. The world works. God is in control. Black is black, white is white, right is right, wrong is wrong, good is rewarded, evil is punished. We used Psalm 145 last week as an exploration of what it looks like to be oriented in a world where God has provided so profoundly for His people through His interjection of Himself into the story and through the amazing creation that supplies so many of our needs all around us. Today we're going to be talking about Psalms of disorientation. Psalms of disorientation is the exact opposite, as you might guess. Nothing is as it should be. God is apparently absent. Life is out of control. All we see before us is gray. Evil is rewarded. Justice is perverted. And we turn to the heavens and we're met with silence. Psalms of disorientation. Next week, we'll be talking about Psalms of reorientation. Life, reality, it's complex. Yes, it is. In the midst of chaos, we begin to discern patterns and order. There's some kind of restoration that's happening in our lives, but it's in a way that's different than where we came from. We recognize that there's no going back to where we were, only going through to this new place where God may be reorienting us and leading us to. We're not sure exactly where God is, but even so, we believe God is faithful, and our life is increasingly surrendered in trust, even though we are not in control. You know, here's my assessment of that trajectory, orientation, disorientation, reorientation in our lives. Man, do we love orientation and reorientation, right? Life works, and life is beginning to work again. But disorientation, we just as soon skip that step, yes? Truly, we really would. And as a result of our desire to skip through or ignore or disregard disorientation, we have no idea how to engage God in the midst of that very critical part of our journey or critical part, because it's not just one time that that often happens in our lives. But when we experience disorientation, we assume fundamentally that something is wrong with God or something is wrong with me, and as a result, we shut down and we disappear either literally or figuratively. We just check out because we have no language with which to know how do we engage God. How would we begin to engage God in a place of absolute disorientation? We're not fluent in the language of disorientation. And I've got to tell you, today, this is not an easy topic for me to preach about. Not because I'm disoriented, but because on Monday night when the Kansas Jayhawks won the national championship, my entire world reoriented. Just kidding. I mean, it's true. It is true. But I actually I feel like I have a little bit of a perverse excitement in talking about this today, disorientation. Because it is a place of real difficulty, and I'm excited about talking about it. Why? Because I think we all experience this, and yet we rarely find permission to talk about it. To know how to bring our doubts and our struggles and our confusion and our anger, even rage, to God, at God, before God, in any kind of way that is authentic or true. And so today we are going to embrace disorientation. And for some of you, that will be disorienting because you're not used to talking about faith in these ways. Your world is oriented. It's working. And so our time together today may be disorienting. For others of you, talking about disorientation will actually be very orienting because this is where you live right now and you've assumed that something is wrong. And this will be an opportunity to engage. I know a lot of people in this place of disorientation right now. In fact, a couple people came up to me last week and said, I was grateful, Tim, for you talking about the trajectory on the front end, orientation, disorientation, reorientation. I got to tell you, I'm in complete disorientation right now, and it was so hard to sit and listen to you talk about orientation because that is just not where I am, and I don't think I can take it anymore. And so the reality is we all find ourselves at different times in our lives in this place. And I'm not going to be able, and we're not going to be able to talk about all that could or should be said about this, but we are going to dive in. And so this morning our text, our Psalm of Disorientation, is found in Psalm 88. Grant's going to put it up there, and I'm going to invite you to read along with me, except not speak. I want you to listen and read along because I want you to absorb what is being said in this psalm. And oftentimes when we're trying to read and speak out loud at the same time, we're so intent upon getting the words right that we don't allow them to soak in. So I'm going to read to us this morning this psalm. And I pray that you would allow yourself to be open to what's being said here. Psalm 88. Lord, you are the God who saves me. Day and night I cry out to you. May my prayer come before you. Turn your ear to my cry. I am overwhelmed with troubles, and my life draws near to death. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like one without strength. I am set apart with the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, who are cut off from your care. You have put me in the lowest pit, in the darkest depths. Your wrath lies heavily on me. You have overwhelmed me with all your waves. You have taken from me my closest friends and have made me repulsive to them. I am confined. I cannot escape. My eyes, they are dim with grief. I call to you, Lord, every day. I spread out my hands to you. Do you show your wonders to the dead? Do the spirits rise up and praise you? Is your love declared in the grave, your faithfulness in destruction? Are your wonders known in the place of darkness, or your righteous deeds in the land of oblivion? But I cry to help. I cry to you for help, Lord. In the morning, my prayers come before you. Why, Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me? From my youth, I have suffered and been close to death. I have borne your terrors and am in despair. Your wrath has swept over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. All day long they surround me like a flood. They have completely engulfed me. You have taken from me friend and neighbor. Darkness is my closest friend. Psalm 88. Have you ever read that before? Do you remember? It's not quite Psalm 23, is it? Is anyone surprised by what we've just heard, what we've just read, Psalm 88? I mean, honestly, is anyone surprised? Yeah? What's surprising about that psalm? Yeah. So the psalmist's honesty is really threatening on some level, because here we have a person who's described as having God's own heart and who's bringing this thing to God, and we're afraid of being that honest, aren't we, for some reason? Yeah, did it surprise anybody else? What was surprising about the psalm? Or what stood out in the psalm, David? Enormous anger, yes? Yeah, what else? Yeah, just straight from the heart to the mouth. It's just all pouring out. Kelly? Yeah, accusation. Yeah, yeah. It in some ways opposes what we hear about God being faithful. There's accusation coming against God. You have done this to me. And it goes in the face of what we interpret God's way in our lives to be, yes? Good. What else stood out? Yeah, Jerry. Okay, so the psalmist is still present. He's still waiting. He's not given up. I saw a hand over here. Yes. There's still a sense of relationship going on. What emotions come through this psalm? What are the emotions that you hear or that you feel emanating out of the author of this psalm? Despair? Desperation? Confusion? No other alternative, backed into a corner. Hopelessness, fear, loneliness. Yeah, twice. You've taken not just yourself away from me, but everybody around me you've removed as well. You know my only companion now? Darkness. Yeah, yeah. As you heard, as you read through this with me, what emotions were evoked in you? Similar things? Confusion maybe reading this? Say again? Rejection? Relief. How so? Yeah. Some relief. Because here's somebody who is describing some of the ways I've felt, and yet they're aiming these emotions not at themselves in blame, but at God in blame. Blaming God for this. Can you identify a time in your life when you have felt the emotions that we've described here? Anger, bitterness, resentment, desperation, being backed into a corner, being isolated, being alone, being afraid. Have you felt these things in your life? What did you do with those emotions when you felt them? What was going on in you? What was going on around you during that time? Maybe presently, maybe in the past. What was happening? And what did you do with what you were feeling and experiencing? To pray, to praise, to be in the Psalms is a place of extraordinary vulnerability. We see in this psalm an unrelieved instance of total disorientation. You know, you read through the Psalms, and there are Psalms where the psalmist is a little bit lost, but by the end of the psalm, everything comes back in order. You know what I'm talking about? So there's pleading and pleading going on, but it ends in praise because the psalmist ends up declaring, well, but God will make this better. Psalm 88 stands alone in all the psalms as one of unrelieved, absolute, utter hopelessness. God, where are you? It does not move away from the displacement that the psalmist, that the poet is writing. It's a direct and forceful accusation, a shaking of the fist at heaven. He names his troubles, and what does he do? He lays them right at the feet of God. You have done this. Accusatory you language. You ever get into it with somebody and you're going like this, they're like, put down that finger. The psalmist is clearly going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da at God. And I think that, for most of us, is disorienting. As the psalm builds, its intensity and desperation grows. The language is getting more and more and more disruptive, greater and greater and greater pursuit, and a relentless honesty about what he's experiencing. His language matches the intensity of whatever circumstances are conspiring in his life to isolate him in the way that he's being isolated. If we look at the psalm and break it down, it's interesting what happens in kind of the orientation of the psalm. The psalm begins in the first two verses addressing God. Lord, you, let me remind you who you are, because you don't seem to remember. You are the God who saves me. Day and night, if you're not paying attention, I'm the one crying out to you. May my prayer come before you. Turn your ear to my cry. God, this is what I need from you. I'm talking to you. By the way, you are the God who saves me, right? Here's what I need. I need you to start paying attention, because you haven't been. Then the psalmist in verses 3 through 5 makes several statements of I'm in trouble. I am overwhelmed with troubles, and my life draws near to death. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like one who is without strength. I am set apart with the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, who are cut off from your care. An honest assessment of where the psalmist is. Do we know where we are sometimes? Are we honest with God about where we find ourselves? I. Then in the next three verses, verses 6 through 9, three you statements of accusation. You, God, you have put me in this pit, in the darkest depths. Your wrath lies heavily on me. You have overwhelmed me with all of your waves. You have taken from me my closest friends and have made me repulsive to them. I am confined and cannot escape. My eyes, they are dim with grief. So I call out to you and spread my hands before you. The psalmist saying, here's where I am, and here's my assessment of where you are or where you're not. Then what I love, the negotiation starts. Verses 10 through 14, a series of rhetorical questions, trying to provoke God into activity. Okay, here's where I am, and you seem to be ignorant. I mean, number one, you're the cause of it. Number two, you're not paying attention to me. Do you show your wonders to the dead? Do their spirits rise up and praise you? If you kill me, if you allow me to die, do the dead, are they the ones that can praise you? Only the living can, God. Is your love declared in the grave, your faithfulness in destruction? Are your wonders known in the places of darkness, or your righteous deeds in the land of oblivion? But I cry to you for help. In the morning, my prayer comes before you. Why, Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me? Then the psalm, verses 15 through 18. And this is tough. There's just no getting around it. It concludes in utter hopelessness. God, you have left me. I'm on my own. You have taken from me friend or neighbor. Darkness is my closest friend. Now, my question to you this morning. This psalm, is this psalm demonstrate a lack of faith, or is it an expression of faith? Does this psalm demonstrate a lack of faith, or is it an expression of it? And why? Sin. Yeah. Is real. So Sin's comment is that this psalm expresses a profound relationship, that there's tremendous faith here, but yet the hopelessness that the person on one end of the relationship feels isn't changed by the reality of the relationship. Good. Other comments? A lack of faith or a sign of faith? Yes. Okay. Okay, verse 13 says, Lord, I'm going to keep pleading with you day by day. And so the recognition that for the psalmist, this honesty about his location in his life does not mean that the relationship is somehow severed by what he's experiencing. Rather, it becomes the ground by which he then engages, this place of openness and honesty. Any other comments? Kelly? It's both a lack of faith and a desperate holding on to faith. Any comments about that? Yeah. 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 So with one hand, you're desperately clinging to the reality of what you hope and believe is true, but you're also being honest about the reality of where you are and where there's things missing and how in life you have to be honest about both sides of that equation. And so it's a place of real, the word I'm going to use here is liminality. You're between places. It'd be easy to be either in one place or the other, but this place in between, you know, Israel in the wilderness, they didn't like that. Let's go back to Egypt or let's get to the promised land. But this wilderness wandering, no thanks. Yeah? Yeah. Disorientation in faith. We don't have many categories for it. But let me say this. Folks, the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of love and the opposite of hate, of faith in both instances is apathy. It's indifference. When you hate, when you doubt, you're still in relationship. It creates a possibility for further engagement. It's when we discover indifference or apathy in ourselves that we have to begin to be scared. The opposite of love is apathy. The opposite of faith is apathy. And there is no apathy to be found in this psalm, right? This is a desperate engagement of somebody who wants God to be present in their life, and for whatever reason, it is not happening. The psalm addresses God, desperate, angry, alone. However, the psalmist never seems to consider withdrawing. I'm not going to cut out this conversation. God, just because you're silent doesn't mean that I'm going to stop talking. See, I think this silence, this absence, this disorientation drives Israel to more intense, passionate, and honest prayer. The niceties are being stripped away, and even if God doesn't answer, Israel's going to keep engaging. The Hebrew word Israel means what? One who wrestles, one who contends with God. I mean, one of the things I love about reading the Old Testament is the men and women who just continually are in negotiations with God. God, you say this, you're going to judge these people. What if I find 50 righteous people? Okay, what about 40? Okay, what about 30? Okay, what about 5? Will you not destroy it? In other words, Jacob wrestling the angel, being, you know, limped. To be in relationship to God is to contend. I think God sometimes spoils for a good fight. And we're just wusses. Come on, is that all you got? What I hear Israel saying is, hey, you started this covenant. You're not living up to it. So I'm going to stay here until you start. Prayer is the meeting ground where sparks fly. Like Job, the prayer of Psalm 88 stands his ground and demands to be answered. Have you ever engaged God this way? What causes this kind of disorientation in our lives? What are the things that happen in our lives that lead to the possibility of this kind of response to God? Give me some feedback. What are the different things that happen in our lives? Yeah, Katie? Okay. When we have our picture or pattern of how we think life is going to work and it doesn't go according to plans. Okay, good. What else? What else goes on specifically, broadly in our lives that causes this kind of disorientation? Yeah. Tragedy. Abuse. Death. Disease. Change. Yeah, sometimes the kind of things that happen in our life are situational or circumstantial. We experience loss of some kind. Maybe it's a death. Maybe it's the ending of a relationship. Maybe it's financial difficulties that we can't get ourselves out of. Maybe we've been defeated or opposed in something. Sometimes this is physiological. We're dealing with depression. Our bodies aren't doing things that we want them to do. It causes disorientation. We're not in control. And guess what, folks? Sometimes it's circumstantial. Sometimes it's physiological. Sometimes it's formational. Sometimes God takes us into these places. What has been called the dark night of the soul, in order to cause us to grow and mature in our journey of faith. Yes, sometimes circumstances create an environment where the only thing we can do is lament and grieve and complain to God about what's happened in our lives. Sometimes our bodies are doing things that need attention, both medically and spiritually, and that cause us to feel like we're in a black pit. Other times it's formational. God leads us into the valley of the shadow of death and is silent as a part of our journey, as a part of our maturity, as a part of growing. And if we don't know how to engage God in the midst of that place, then we will assume, like the psalmist does, and rightly so, that we've been abandoned. And so what's the point in continuing? Versus learning how to authentically and truly continue to engage with God from this place of desperation and disorientation. It is critical that we find ways to express the reality of who we are and where we are with integrity and authenticity. Can I tell you something? God is not afraid of your emotions. Nor does He need you to defend Him. Can I say that again? God is not afraid of your emotions. Nor does He need you to defend Him. God is quite capable of defending Himself. We are often the ones who are afraid of our emotions, yes? In fact, in order to complain and lament, we must first acknowledge what we are feeling and then feel it. And that's often the most painful thing. We just bury that stuff and just try to plow through, yes? In hopes that maybe it'll just slough off somewhere along the way. Most of us spend more of our energy anesthetizing our pain or killing it through sex or alcohol or busyness or achievement or money or whatever those things are, rather than stopping long enough to feel the trauma of what we've experienced it and figuring out how to bring it with authenticity before God. You know one of the coolest things I've learned about in the last year? In India, there's this church called the Martoma Church. I don't know if you know this historical tradition, but when Jesus ascended and the disciples became the apostles, the tradition is that Doubting Thomas became a mission. They are all missionaries to different parts of the world, and that Doubting Thomas went through India and ended in the very southern tip of India. There is a thousands of year old tradition of the Martoma Church, Son of Thomas. The belief is that there's this ancient Indian tradition of Christianity at a place so far away that people are beginning to think maybe Thomas was the missionary that founded this church. You know one of the things they do regularly in the Martoma Church, because their founding patron is Doubting Thomas? Yearly, they have a mass of doubt. They ritualize the recognition that as human beings trying to follow a bizarre and mysterious God, that things aren't always easy, and so they bring together their community and say, together, we're going to bring before God our doubt as an act of worship. That's good. That's healthy. The Israelites, many cultures, sackcloths, ashes, wailing, mourning, gnashing teeth. We're polite. You know the only thing worse than not expressing, though? The true reality of where we are before God. You know the one thing worse than not giving expression to the place we find ourselves? Sharing it with somebody who needs to fix you. You ever had that experience? Being in a place of profound alienation and disorientation and sharing it with somebody who neither needs to defend God or fix you. It's like Job's friends. I call that meaningless God talk. There's nothing worse. It only isolates you further. So if you find yourself in this place, be careful who you tell it to. Because oftentimes, people are unwilling to go to that place themselves, and for you to be in that place is very threatening for them. It is isolating. But the psalmist, who is utterly alone, still continues to contend with God in this place. Folks, you can't behave or believe yourself out of a place of disorientation. You just can't. It's part of the journey of faith that we must pass through. Faithful Christians throughout the history of the church have done this. And most recently, Mother Teresa got a lot of press, right? Because it came out, her journals, about the amount of time she spent in this dark night of the soul. People who are atheists assume that that meant she never had an authentic faith. Wrong. It means that for people who are faithful Christians, we still struggle and experience profound seasons of isolation in our life. And yet, we continue to wrestle with God. I think we spend a lot of time and energy denying and resisting dislocation. But folks, eventually, you have to accept it and embrace it. See, the reality is there's no going back to where you were. There's only going forward to the new place you are being led. And oftentimes we want to get back to the place of orientation where life was simple and easy. But you can't ever get back there. It's only by accepting and embracing where you are now that God can then lead you to a new place. Denial does no good. There comes a time when you recognize the old orientation is gone and it's not retrievable, and no amount of pleading changes that. You have to remember where you've been, then turn and face what is before, living into and not resisting the disorientation. There is life there, even though it seems like death. Just as Christ leaned into the chaos and the disorientation of the cross. He did not go back to the feeding of the 5,000 when he was still popular. He pressed into the darkness and emerged on the other side. This morning, as a conclusion and participation opportunity in our time, you'll notice that in your pew, we do this periodically, there's little post-it notes stuck to the thing here and cups of pencils. I invite you, those of you who are on the end of the rows, to grab one of those, grab a pencil, and then pass them in. And what we're going to do in our time of worship and communion is to give you an opportunity, at least initially, to process through these things. Addressing God, I statements, you statements, negotiating, questions, declarations. What we're going to do is I'm going to have us read four separate verses with pauses of time between them to act as prompts. And then as we finish that up, the band will come forward to lead us in worship. And then as we come forward to communion, if you're at a place where you want to, I invite you to bring your laments, your complaints, your questions up, and before you receive communion, to place them on the altar, to allow them to be stuck there as a sign of your pursuit and engagement with God in this place. And perhaps you're not in a place of disorientation, but perhaps you remember one that you might want to use as an opportunity, or perhaps you might think about somebody you know and complain and lament on their behalf as an act of solidarity with them in their suffering versus trying to fix them. Let's pull that first slide up. I want you to read this out loud with me this time. I am overwhelmed with troubles. I am like one without strength. Join me. I am forgotten, abandoned as a lost cause. I am caught in a maze and cannot find a way out. Pray with me. You've turned my friends against me, made me horrible to them. In our last slide, for as long as I remember, I've been hurting. The only friend I have left is darkness. As you write, listen. For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." Oftentimes we talk about communion as a place to receive nourishment, as a willingness to accept the pattern of Jesus' life. This morning I'd like to add a third category for how we might open ourselves up to God in this place of communion. It's an opportunity for us to identify with God in his suffering. That just as God himself did not remain aloof from struggle and disorientation, but engaged it fully, the cross becomes a place of ultimate disorientation and eventually reorientation, but true disorientation. And so to allow ourselves to be identified with that in this act of sacramental connection with God is a place of unity and connection. So I invite you to come forward this morning to receive the body and the blood of Christ, to identify with the suffering of God, and to allow your suffering to be covered in God's suffering. Also, if you're a person here this morning who would like prayer wherever you find yourself, our prayer team is obviously here in our prayer chapel, and so please take advantage of the opportunity that that presents for us to engage with God. Let us continue to worship, to contend, to complain, to lament, to rejoice, and to engage with God as we practice this sacrament. If you'd like to place your psalm, your words on the altar, then let me invite you to do that as well.